Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas is now in session pursuant to adjournment.
Thank you. Be seated. Justice Ray and Justice Hightower are unavoidably absent this morning, but they will participate in the deliberation and the decision of all three of these causes. The orders of the court for this week are posted in the clerk's office and available for inspection. Three causes will be submitted this morning at oral argument. In the order in which they will be presented, they are as follows. Brenda Llewellyn Bockelman versus Samuel T. Marnick and Edux from Dallas County. William J. Viles Edux versus Security National Insurance Company and others from Tarrant County. And Mortimer R. Wilkeem and others versus the First Court of Appeals on original mandamus proceeding. In each of these causes, the court by order has allowed it 20 minutes for petitioner to present oral argument, 20 minutes for respondent to present oral argument, and 10 minutes for rebuttal. In between each of these arguments, the court will take a brief recess. Counsel in the second and third causes did not have to remain in the courtroom during earlier arguments, but we ask that you remain nearby. And counsel in all three causes are advised that these arguments are being recorded for the convenience of the court. If you desire to listen to the tapes of these arguments, you may make application to do so with the clerk of our court. We are now ready to hear oral argument from petitioner in Bockelman v. Marnick.
May it please the court, Michael Hatchell will present argument for the petitioner.
May it please the court, it's my pleasure to represent Brenda Bockelman Gaba as petitioner in this cause. This is my first official appearance in this case. The court may or may not have noticed that virtually all of the lawyers on the briefs are law professors, and the petitioner is also married to a law professor, and a strange phenomenon that I have discovered is that law professors are very shy about appearing before any group whose papers they cannot grade and that can talk back to them. So I've been elected to present Brenda's very appealing case. I think it is fair to say that this is a case of first impression. It involves the ramifications of one joint tenant holding over after a joint tenancy. The court, I'm sure, is quite familiar with the outcome of the case. It seems to me there are multiple choices that are available to the court, and it makes it somewhat frustrating for me to argue this morning. There is, I think I would be remiss if I did not say, an unattacked ground before the Court of Appeals in the form of a novation. The Court's not granted writ on that, and I do not intend to argue it, but I must say that coming into this case independently, it seems to me to be a very appealing ground. And it is one that perhaps the Court at least needs to look at before it proceeds to the merits of the case, because it is quite clear the trial court made presumed findings on novation. Those were not attacked in the Court of Appeals. Well, the Court of Appeals did dispose of the novation argument. I don't understand how that was done without any points being raised on it, but be that as it may, that exists in the case. When you get to the merits of the case, there are also two avenues I think the court can proceed down. Well, one is an avenue which simply says at the conclusion of a joint tenancy, the holding over by one of the joint tenants creates a holdover only as to that tenant. That might be called a cold steel rule. The other rule which the court might be interested in considering and has been talked about in some of the cases is one which creates a presumption that the holdover is joint, but that presumption can be rebutted by proof. That is the theory that the Court of Appeals seems to have pursued in this case. It is clearly the theory of the dissent. The point of departure is the quality of proof necessary to pierce the presumption. The facts in this case are simple enough. Husband and wife make a joint residency lease. Marital discord occurs immediately prior to the termination of that lease. A wife leaves the premises. The landlords know of this departure on that day. They know in the midst of a subsequent holdover period by the husband alone that she is not there. They know before the start of the holdover period for which wife is being held in this case that the separation is permanent and that a divorce has been filed.
Did, there, that it's, they know before what time that the separation is planned?
Brenda Bockelman has been held liable on the second holdover period. The Court of Appeals has held that the first holdover period has been satisfied by obligations, so that becomes moot. During the midst of the first holdover period, it is perfectly clear that the Marinics, who are the lessors in this case, having already known before the start of the first holdover period that she was gone, they now know that this separation is permanent, and they know
were there
that
findings on that, or is that undisputed?
Well, there are no findings at all in this case, so yes, indeed, there were presumed findings. Now, then there is more than ample evidence to support that from the level of...
Is that the presumption to... You're saying that is a presumed finding to support the judgment of the judge.
Absolutely.
How did they know that the separation was final when the parties...
Because Dr. Marinick said that he knew that. He said that in a conversation with the sister of Brenda, that he learned that the separation was found. This is a 49-page record, and the statements are very, in this record, are very explicit. And Dr. Marinick stated that he knew that. And he stated he knew about the divorce in December of 1986, before the beginning of the second holdover period.
So this really isn't, there's not contested evidence here, it's just purely a legal question.
Well, they will raise what they think are some mitigating facts, but as this court knows, under the proper analysis of the evidence, those facts vanish, and we look only at those facts that are favorable to the judgment. The question of notice and knowledge of not only the departure on the day that it occurred, but the permanent nature of that departure, is, for all practical purposes, undisputed and unchallenged in this court.
So, does the fact of even filing the divorce terminate her liability?
Well,
especially for necessary.
It seems to me, gets you back more to a contractual argument in this case. The Court of Appeals has found against the Marinics on their contractual argument, and they've also found against them on the necessaries by entering a specific finding that there was no evidence that this contract was necessary. That has not been brought forward by any cross points in the response to the application, which in fact was only filed last week, and certainly under City of San Antonio versus Davis, those issues have exited the case also. So the only issue really before the court is the nature of the holdover tenancy. Let me tell you why I am not at all uncomfortable with what I would call the more a simple rule, the one that does not involve a presumption. I am impressed by the fact that this jurisdiction, along with all jurisdictions, at least from City of San Antonio versus French, has construed holdover tenancies to essentially be contractual in nature. The holdover is, as I read the cases, is more or less construed in law to be an offer by the tenant to remain, giving the landlord the option to accept or reject. So this rule really does imply a sort of a consensual contractual undertaking. It implies decision-making and face-to-face dealings between the holdover and the landlord, because the landlord is not locked into a holdover. He has the option to reject, and frequently in a holdover situation, the quality of the tenancy which is holding over is very important to the landlord. And I think that it is simply not a harsh rule to require the landlord in a contractual, voluntary situation to simply know who it is he is dealing with, and to require him to at least know the nature of the holdover tenancy.
How is he to find out, for example, in this case, if he asks the husband expresses that he hopes his wife will move back in. If he can't find the wife, then does he presume that there is or is not a holdover?
Yeah, I think he's on notice at that time that there's not a holdover by the wife.
And so if he said, all right, I'm not going to let her hold over, and then the husband vacates, and the wife decides a couple of weeks later she does want to move back in,
she's out. She's out in this instance.
What if the landlord is in another city?
Well, that's unfortunate. I'm not too concerned about that.
Well, some of us have had to move
Absolutely.
From one town to another.
Yes,
you know?
That's right.
Were you a
resident? No, but I would have been if there had been a tenant. I was available to be a rent.
I think that's, you know, it's a concern because there are all manners of situations which can come up. But I don't have extraordinary sympathy with the landlord in that situation in dealing with holdovers because he is making a contract. He has the option to reject. And if he is so uninterested in the situation that he's just going to enter into these contractual relationships and make decisions there on in absentia, then I think he bears whatever the consequences may result from that. There is a rule, which I think is helpful, Your Honor, in this, which may help clarify, a companion rule that says that if a lease is executed jointly and there are renewal rights, that one tenant cannot exercise those renewal rights and thereby bind the other one. And it seems to me like there ought to be a companion rule that if the tenancy is joint, we are going to say that the holding over by one tenant is more or less equivalent to the ability or inability of joint tenants to renew. It seems to me like this puts an equality into the situation if we adhere to that rule. But the landlord, it seems to me, ought to gain no greater rights in a holdover situation than he gains in an extension situation, which is another rule, another reason why I think that the most direct approach to this case is a good one.
Well, doesn't there have to be a presumption one way or the other in the absence of some expression of intent by the parties? Either it's presumed that the tenant is holding over or it's presumed that the tenant is not holding over. Then have to fall on one side or the other.
Well, I don't know that in a situation where one of the joint tenants has vacated that there is necessarily a presumption, because bear in mind that the law puts an end to that lease. But so I would say that as a legal consequence, that tenant is not holding over. Now, as to the other tenant, I don't know if he's actually in possession. I don't think that you have a need for any presumption at all because you've got physical possession. One of the things which I think is also important, which is endemic to Texas law, is Judge Wilson's holding in the Cropier case, which says that if we have a written lease which raises holdover rights, that governs the rights of the parties, and you don't look to common law principles. And one thing that I think has been overlooked in this case, which lends support to our argument, is the fact that this particular lease provides for no rent for any following year except through negotiation of the parties. The lease specifically says that the rent for any following year after the initial term is going to be subject to inflation and subject to cost of living adjustments and subject to taxes and the like. Once again, this is a specific, unique factor which is injected into this particular case, which puts the parties in contact with one another and which puts their ultimate subsequent relationship after the holdover on a consensual and contractual relationship.
There is also a provision in the lease that allows the tenant to terminate during the holdover period with 60 days notice.
That's correct.
Why didn't the wife, in this case, exercise that provision?
Well, first of all, she had left the relationship. She probably, whether or not she did or did not know the nature of the holding over, we don't know, but she construed the law as we're construing it to you today, that her vacation was essentially an ending of her tenancy, and she bore no further obligation. That any holding over by her estranged husband was his holding over alone.
Under your theory, when would the landlord be bound to extend the lease for at least an additional 60 days, subject to his giving notice that the holdover period is terminated? Under under what circumstances would he be bound to extend the lease period? The next day after end of the new period, or at what point?
Are you talking about accepting a holdover?
Yes.
Yes. He accepts the holdover within a reasonable period of time, either expressly or by accepting rent payments, and he did accept rent payments in this case, so that more or less fixed the holdover period.
But to take a hypothetical, if if the husband in this case, whose name I've forgotten, had moved out a couple of weeks after the beginning of the holdover period, and the wife had decided to move back in,
she's out and he's in bad shape.
The landlord would not be required to extend the lease an additional time.
That would be my interpretation. That's exactly correct, because the landlord is king of the mountain in that situation. One other additional fact that I want to make is Article 5.22 of the Family Code, which I think has not been talked about enough in this case. This lease was jointly signed by both parties. And as I read Section 5.22, parenthesis C, of the Family Code, you do not have an extension of a jointly executed contract unless you deal with both. And there, I think, is another unique Texas-based factor, which pretty much tells us, since the landlord could not possibly have dealt with both in regard to the holdover period, that Brenda's leaving terminated the period. And I want to also say that the case of Fronty versus Wood, which is bandied about as great authority for the Court of Appeals and is used by opposing counsel, is for us. It would have been nice had the Court of Appeals and opposing counsel actually gotten the opinion in Fronty versus Wood, and I did. I got it from the South Carolina Archives. And Fronty versus Wood was worried about the fact that the tenancy which commenced in that case was at all times a tenancy with one party absent. But they spoke to our situation when they said it might have been different had both been in occupancy of the house and Wood had gone out at the end of the year. This would have been notice to the landlord that he ceased to hold, but without some notice, I think he would not throw off his liability for the rent. Well, if you don't like my arguments relative to determining this case on the simple non-holding over of one joint tenant, I think everybody is in agreement that a presumption, at least, one rule would be that a presumption of holding over jointly may well have existed, but that this was a rebuttable presumption. Judge Keaton Dean Keaton, in one of his very articles on presumption, speaks of the nature of presumptions in Texas and classifies almost all of them, except some of the most draconian statutory presumptions, as of the rebuttable type, which vanish more or less like a bubble when at least prima facie evidence is introduced. If the court chooses to adopt that approach, we win, because the presumption, of course, would be regulatory only. It was triggered when we made proof that the landlords knew of Brenda's departure the day it occurred. They knew of serious marital discard before beginning of the second holdover period. They negotiated with Herman alone to satisfy the rent for the first holdover period. They knew of the permanency of the separation by December prior to the second holdover period, and they knew of the divorce itself in January. That pierced any presumption. The presumed findings by the trial court stand, and they being unchallengeable in this court, we went under that theory as well.
But your primary theory is that even without that notice, if the landlord does not check and see after the term expires who's there, the presumption is, even if it's unknown to him, that the tenant's not holding over.
I think in a situation of two joint tenants who are not an enterprise, and in a situation where there is notice, whether it's done by checking or whether it's just acquired by extraneous actual notice, that is the rule. I'm not saying that I prefer one over the other. I've argued a little bit more on the first one because in examining this case, I find myself very comfortable with it. I find that it's an equitable a two-way street. I recognize that this court is faced with some policy choices. However, you have the additional situation where you have a tenancy which begins with one resident and one non-resident tenant, and it stays that way throughout. What's fair in that instance? What's fair in an instance where neither of the joint tenants are ever in occupancy? Are these the kinds of cases which augur more for the presumption type approach? I don't know. The only thing I can tell you is that the Sabra case, which is the best case on the subject so far, is not uncomfortable with applying the first rule in all situations. But I recognize that there are differing situations in which the court is going to have to try to fashion a rule to accommodate both. All I'm saying is, in this situation, where you simply have a joint tenancy, and the joint tenants don't represent an entity, one of them leaves, and there is notice of that fact, I think that is sufficient for this case.
Do you think we'll have similar problems finding Funny versus Wood?
I'm going to give it to you.
Okay, because your brief only has the page.
I'm going to leave you everything. It's handwritten, and I have Xeroxes of it, and I'm going to reproduce it in the best way that I know how, and I had to read it with a big thing, but I do intend to give it to the court and opposing counsel as well.
Thank you, counsel. Court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
Yes, please, court. Andrew Barr will present arguments for the respondent.
May it please the court. First, I'd like to comment on the factual matter that came up during petitioner's argument. In regard to when Dr. Marinick learned that the separation would be final, that a divorce was going to be consummated. First, the lease provides on its face that the lease term is from March 1, '84 through February 28, '85. So the original term is 84-85. So the first holdover term was 85-86, and the second holdover term was from March 1986 through February of '87. Now the record is, Dr. Marinick's testimony is that he learned in December of '86. That was his best recollection. He learned in approximately December of 86 that the divorce would be consummated, or that the separation would be permanent. That is well into the second holdover term. Prior to that point in time, including at the commencement of the second holdover term, all the information was, according to Mr. Bockelman, that he was very hopeful, he was very optimistic that the parties would reconcile and they would live together again. Now, let me turn and emphasize some points that I think are pertinent or particularly important to the respondent's case. First, I think it's important to understand that the petitioner here is bound by her act. She is the person that signed the lease adjacent to the word tenant. She bound herself to the terms of the lease. She bound herself to pay rent. She bound herself to deliver the premises in good condition, normal wear and tear accepted. She bound herself to deliver the premises at the end of the lease term unoccupied. She bound herself to do all those things. And in binding herself as a co-maker, she assumed certain risk, as all co-makers do. If Herman Bockelman didn't pay the rent as a co-maker, she was obligated to pay the rent. If Herman Bockelman tore the place up, then she was obligated for his acts as a co-maker. And if Herman Bockelman failed to surrender the premises at the end of the lease term, she was obligated as a co-maker, because she had the obligation to deliver the premises unoccupied at the end of the lease term. She didn't do that. She didn't do that. Now, when the premises are retained by the tenant a holding over occurs, and the presumption arises. The presumption is that the tenant occupies the premises under the same terms and conditions that existed under the lease that the party signed.
Let's suppose that she does give notice to the landlord that she's vacated, as you say she should have.
Yes, sir.
Does that then end the lease? I mean, is it the landlord's option to tell the husband to leave as well?
I'm not sure the court has to address that issue to resolve this case, but the California case that we cited as precedent, the Smith case, accorded to the tenant a right to terminate the lease. In that case, there had been two or three holdover periods, and during one of these holdover periods, the tenant gave notice that he was not going to be bound after the end of the holdover period. The court held that tenant liable during the holdover periods that occurred prior to the giving of the notice, but said that the notice was effective at the end of what amounted to the current holdover period. That's a rule that we can live with, a rule that I think is appropriate. It provides an opportunity for the tenant to give notice, for the landlord to assess the situation and decide whether or not he wants to look to the holding over tenant alone. And if he chooses not to, then he can require that tenant to surrender the premises.
A married couple that the marriage fails, and if they happen to have a favorable lease arrangement for some reason, one party will always see that the other party doesn't have the advantage of that, because to escape their own liability, they have to get notice, and then the landlord can get out of whatever the arrangement is, right? Or you would only have this for holdovers?
I would only have this for holdovers.
And in a holdover situation, forgive this question, does the landlord have the right to, well, this one they're going to renegotiate, this is an unusual one because they're going to renegotiate the amount of the lease at the end of each holdover period.
I did not, during the argument, go back and look at that provision. And as I recall, the lease says that there is a holdover provision that says in the lease that says it will continue on the same terms and conditions. I just have to look at it. I think there is a provision that says the rate can be. I don't know that it's mandatory that it be renegotiated. And in this case, it was as such not renegotiated. The same rate was applicable throughout the holdover periods. And I think under the presumption that the parties would be bound to the rate that existed under the original lease. The point I wanted to stress in regard to the presumption is that the presumption is that the same...
What presumption are we talking about? The presumption in regard to holdover tenancy, or the presumption that if he did not request findings of fact and conclusions of law, we presume facts that can be and theory that and look at the evidence can support the judgment?
Well, I'm talking about the presumption concerning holdovers. The presumption concerning holdovers is that the tenancy continues on the same terms and conditions.
All right. How about Justice Obart's statement in dissent that presumption has been rebutted, and that your client had actual notice of the fact that she was no longer there, and because of the fact that he failed to file a request finding for fact and use of law, that is the basis on which we can support the trial court judgment?
Well, it's a question of law as to whether or not the record supports that judgment. And I would contend that it doesn't, because all the evidence is that the Marinics had information, received information that there was marital discord, that she had moved out. Every time they received information to that effect, they also received information that Mr. Bachelman hoped that they would reconcile, that they would join together and live together again. That was his hope, and that was conveyed frequently by him, as reflected by the record. So the point I want to make is that no information was conveyed to the Bachelmans or received by the Bachelmans concerning any matter pertaining to liability under the lease. What was conveyed to them pertained to marital status, the marital situation, not to liability under the lease. And the Court of Appeals held that those are two separate matters. You can't presume just because she moved out that she's not going to be bound. You can't presume that because there's marital discord that she's not bound by the lease. You can't presume that she's never going to reconcile with her husband and move back in.
Well, how about the actual notice? She was no longer there.
Well,
not a presumption, but actual notice.
Actual notice that she was no longer there is not notice. It's different from notice concerning her obligations under the lease.
If she had said in so many words, I'm leaving and I'm not coming back to the landlord, would that be a surrender of the premises that would be effective as to her, even if her husband stayed in the house?
Well, that moves us into a gray area perhaps, but and those are not the facts here. I would contend, though, that that doesn't release her because it doesn't, it's not a comment, it's not notice under the lease or pertaining to the lease and her obligations under the lease. I have cited some cases in our brief that are landlord-tenant cases that talk about the kind of notice that's required. Now, they're not cases that that arose in this same kind of fact situation. They're adverse possession cases, and they are option to renew cases. But those cases involving rights under leases transactions of significance require that the notice be clear, that it be specific, that it inform the party of the matter at hand. Those cases use phraseology such as the notice must be plain, positive, and clear-cut. And I suggest that while those cases may not be precedent in one sense because they involve, as I say, adverse possession, the running of statute of limitations, and options to renew leases, they do, I think, have persuasive value.
Counsel, but in the state of this record, absence to request a finding of fact and conclusions of law, why can we not presume that those are the very facts that the trial court found support this judgment?
Because the evidence does not reflect any intent on her part regarding the matter of liability under the lease. There's no evidence concerning her intent. She didn't testify. There's no direct evidence concerning her intent in regard to this lease. There is no evidence concerning her intent in regard to this lease. The only evidence is that she moved out.
Isn't that some evidence of intent?
Well, I think that matters are two different matters. It's not necessary that a tenant occupy premises to be bound under a lease. There's no obligation in this lease that she occupy the premises. She signed the lease stating that, knowing that it had a holdover clause in it, knowing that there was holding over under the lease, knowing that she was responsible under the lease.
All of these matters could be dealt with, I take it, expressly in the lease agreement.
Yes.
Everything that's been discussed here this morning could be the subject of an agreement by the parties.
I agree.
Why shouldn't the landlord, who perhaps typically initiates the lease transaction, responsible for putting that in the lease, and if he doesn't, it's presumed against him.
Well, I don't think we should assume or presume that landlords necessarily always dictate the terms of the lease. Terms of the lease are a matter of negotiation, and in any given case, they may be the product of extensive negotiation, or they may, in some instances, be mandated by the tenant. Depends on the bargaining power.
Is there any really serious about that when you're talking about residential leasing, are you?
Well, I would think that the principle of law involved here will apply to all leases.
Is there any evidence in this record as to who initiated the transaction or who drew up the papers?
No, there's not. Now, in regard to the matter of the presumption concerning holding over, the point that I want to stress is that the presumption is that the terms and conditions continue, that the same rights and obligations exist. That's the presumption associated with holding over. There is no exception to that presumption to the effect that a tenant, the presumption doesn't operate when a tenant moves out. There's no exception to the presumption that says the tenant moving out shall deprive the landlord of his rights under the pre-existing lease. And one of the rights that was held by the Marinics in this case was the right to look to Brenda Bockelman for payment of the rent.
Did she do anything that would indicate her willingness or agreement to hold over? Did she herself do anything to that effect?
She was, the record reflects that she was on the premises from time to time after the her original departure from the premises.
But was not living there?
I don't think the record addresses, the record does address that. Mr. Bagelman testified that she did not spend the night there after she separated. But she was present on the premises from time to time, and the Marinics saw her there from time to time.
What if the holdover period had been 1 month instead of a year? Isn't there some point along the way at which if the tenant is not present, the landlord, the presumption no longer operates?
Well, are you asking about a situation where the property is abandoned?
Well, in this case, if, for example, if there was a holdover period, and instead of being for a year, it's only from month to month, and the wife is not present, and months and months and months pass, and the wife is not present, does there come a point, under your theory of the case, at which the landlord must assume that she is not holding over, even though the husband is?
Well, under the Smith case that I mentioned, the California case, there was a month-to-month tenancy there, holdover for month-to-month. And I don't know how many months, I've forgotten how many months were involved, but the tenant was bound up to the point that notice was given. And my response would be that that Brenda Bockelman would be bound, if this were a month-to-month situation, until she gave notice. She signed the agreement, and she's bound under the agreement. She can't depart in silence without concern, and thereby deprive the landlord of its rights, their rights, under the lease. And what she did here was depart in silence without any concern whatsoever for the commitment she made when she signed the lease.
How about the loan aspect of this case, the loan contract that was difficult for me to understand? Can you tell me what the facts are with regard to this loan transaction in the second holdover period?
Yes, as I understand it, the the rent became delinquent, the Marinics...
we're talking about the...
During the first holdover period. I have to go back. I believe it's the first holdover period. The rent became delinquent, they negotiated, they being the Marinics, and Mr. Bachelman negotiated what they called a contract, whereby a schedule was set up under which the rent would be paid, the delinquent rent would be paid beginning at a later date on a monthly basis until, in essence, they caught up.
Why is that not in the way?
We addressed that in our brief in the Court of Appeals because the law is that was an agreement signed by the Marinick and by Mr. Bagelman, but not by Mrs. Bagelman. The law is that as a co-maker, they can negotiate or modify the original arrangement with him, and it's not binding on her. It doesn't affect her. It doesn't diminish their rights against her. It doesn't change their rights against her.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much.
May it please the Court, and very briefly, I sympathize with Mr. Barr's struggling to figure out which facts fit in which holdover period in response to Mr. Justice Gonzalez's question, because I got one fact out of sequence as well. Mr. Barr is absolutely correct that Dr. Marinick's notice of the divorce proceedings did occur into the second holdover period. It was not operative before, but as Mr. Justice Gonzalez suggests, the signing of the contract during the first holdover period, which looks to Herman alone, is a perfectly permissible basis for the inference of the same fact in any event. Counsel begins his argument with the observation that Brenda is required to give this lease free and clear. Well, that's wonderful, but let's just figure out what's fair in this situation, because I'm not telling you exactly what the law is in this situation. She gave it free and clear as far as she could. The law is, although perhaps not established in Texas, very clear in other jurisdictions, that if one joint tenant vacates and intends to vacate, doesn't intend to hold over, and another joint tenant holds, the abandoning joint tenant doesn't have a right of ejectment against the holding over period. They're at that tenant's mercy. And that is why a certain amount of equity has to be induced into this particular situation. So I'm not at all impressed with the fact that there was an obligation for her to give free and clear, because she has done everything that she possibly can in this particular situation.
But the general rule is that the tenant who quits must deliver possession of the landlord.
That's correct.
And so this, your rule would require an adjustment of that rule in the circumstances of co-tenancy at least.
Well, I don't know that it requires an adjustment. I think it simply says that joint tenant's abandoning is sufficient in itself to at least free her of that obligation insofar as holdover rights are concerned. There is the situation, for example, of sick persons holding over. You abandon the entire premises except for one room where your aging mother is on her deathbed. It is held that you have done everything you can in that situation, that the occupancy of a portion of the premises under those circumstances is not a holdover. So I don't know that it's necessarily an amendment to the rule. I think it's just conforming to the rule to this particular situation and the rights and obligations that the abandoning tenant has. When we get, and I think that it's very important to notice what it is that you're being asked to hold in this case. You're being asked to hold that a party to a lease which is terminated by its own terms must give notice to a landlord that lease has terminated. as to this particular party. Because you see what counsel is not is saying here. It's not sufficient to give notice or for the landlord to have actual notice that the joint tenant is gone. You have to serve a formal and official notice that you are not going to be bound beyond the termination of that lease, because that's the only way they can get around the facts in this case. And it's interesting to me that the only case that they cite for this proposition that you not only that you have to give formal notice of an intent not to be bound by a holdover is the Schmidt case out of California. And I would ask the court to notice particularly the holding in that case in relation to holdover tenant Zipkin. Zipkin gave notice to the landlord in the midst of an extended period, but before the first holdover period, as follows. I am no longer associated with the Felix Company. Now, the Felix Company consisted of three people who had jointly leased the premises. That's all he said. And the court said that notice did at least put plaintiff, the landlord, on notice that at the expiration of the term, Zipkin would not be holding over, and it would be incumbent on plaintiff to decide whether or not he would be satisfied to permit his two other co-tenants to hold over. Now, I ask you, what more did the Marinics know, or what less did they know in this case? They knew the day Brenda moved out that she was gone, and I think that's sufficient.
One last question, Mr. Hatchell. Do you agree that parties could have treated all this by agreement?
Yes. Is there a difference in a situation like this one where the holdover term is explicit in the lease that's contemplated and one where the lease is absolutely silent about that and the holdover is purely created through common law?
I have pondered that situation, and I am concerned that the Court of Appeals has mixed common law principles and contractual principles in this case to come to its result. I think that at least insofar as this case is concerned, the fact that I've already noticed is that the contract itself provides for further negotiations between the parties as to the second. You get into to a lot of situations in the common law case as to the extent of the holdover period, and then many cases have statutes which also so govern that as well. So I think to the extent that your contract might modify the length of the holdover period, it may be important. But Judge Wilson's opinion in Cropier is I think very, very important on this case, because it at least puts the focus back onto the contract itself and implies that the subsequent relationships between the parties are contractual in relation to this particular contract.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the first call. The court will take a brief recess.